America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Dick Cheney has checked into the hospital, had his blood clots checked. Apparently, as a result of this, Dennis Kucinich has put on hold for maybe a few hours, maybe a day, his proposal to impeach Dick Cheney. I frankly would have gone ahead with it anyway, but I suppose there's issues of protocol and manners and all that. At the same time, the big news right now, and it's just breaking, is that this little-known office within, oddly enough, the executive branch, that is an office under the president, who is headed by a political appointee, that is to say, a guy who works for George W. Bush, that this little known, his name actually is Wayne Smith. I'm sorry, his name is Scott Block. Wayne Smith is a former Interior Department official who may end up being, you know, giving some testimony here. Anyhow, this little-known agency, it's called the Office of Special Counsel, OSC. You can check it out at osc.gov, and it's actually a very informative website. Who we are, the Office of Special Counsel, an independent federal investigative and prosecutorial agency. Our basic authorities come from three federal statutes: the Civil Service Reform Act, the Whistleblower Protection Act, and the Hatch Act. And it's the Hatch Act that is going to bite this administration in the butt. I've been saying all along, you know, I am a big advocate of the impeachment of Bush and Cheney and Rove and a whole bunch of others. Alberto Gonzalez, now that he's a federal official who can be impeached, for lying us into a war, for authorizing torture in violation of the Geneva Conventions, for international war crimes, for election theft, election fraud, and a whole variety of other things that I think are fairly, you know, wiretapping American citizens without our approval in violation of laws. For a whole variety of things that I think are quite, frankly, very easily demonstrated. But it may be something rather subtle and banal that ends up being the thing that puts these guys in jail or puts them out of office. Starting with Karl Rove. Back in 2003, on July 30th, 2003, Tom Hamburger was a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And at that time, he wrote an article that opens in a rather startling fashion. I mean, back in 2003, this should have been big news, because Tom Hamburger was reporting on crimes being committed by Karl Rove, specifically to the benefit of Senator Gordon Smith. Gordon Smith was up for re-election in 2002. And in in January 2002, Karl Rove was basically bragging about it. Here's the opening from this piece in the Wall Street Journal in July of 2003. In a darkened conference room, White House political strategist Karl Rove was making an unusual address to 50 top managers at the U.S. Interior Department. Now, let me just, before I continue sharing with you Tom Hamburger's piece, share with you, you know, what the Interior Department allows and doesn't allow, or rather, not just the Interior Department, the Hatch Act. The Hatch Act was passed in 1939, and what it says is that if you are a federal employee, you may not use your office, that is your position as a federal employee, you may not use any political power that you have, and you may not use your offices, the physical accoutrements of your office, to promote political activities. In fact, from the OSC.gov website, the Office of Special Counsel's website, there is a list of things that federal and D.C. employees may not do. They may not use official authority to influence or interfere with an election. They may not solicit or discourage political activity of anyone with business before their agency. They may not solicit or receive political contributions. They may not be candidates for public office in partisan elections, and they may not engage in political activity while A, on duty, B, in a government office, C, wearing an official uniform, D, using a government vehicle. and they may not wear partisan political buttons while on duty. There's a whole list of the agencies who are prevented from engaging in partisan political activity, including senior executive service. That would be, you know, the senior officials in the Bush administration, the Office of Special Counsel, which is what Alberto Gonzalez was at the time. Federal employees may not, and then make campaign speeches. I would argue that Karl Rove did a lot of that. They may not campaign for or against a candidate or slate of candidates in partisan elections. They may not distribute campaign material in partisan elections. They may not organize or manage political rallies or meetings. You get this? The Hatch Act is very, very clear. So now here we are, 2003, the Wall Street Journal. Tom Hamburger reporting on something that had happened a year earlier. In a darkened conference room, White House political strategist Karl Rove was making an unusual address to 50 top managers at the U.S. Interior Department. Now, you get understanding, as you do now, what the Hatch Act says, that that first sentence says Karl Rove broke the law. Flashing color slides, Karl Rove spoke of poll results, critical constituencies, and water levels in the Klamath River Basin. At the time of the meeting in January 2002, Mr. Rove had just returned from accompanying President Bush on a trip to Oregon, where they visited with a Republican senator facing re-election. That would be Gordon Smith. Republican leaders there wanted to support their agricultural base. In other words, they wanted money and political support from farmers by diverting water from the river basin to nearby farms, and Mr. Rove signaled that the administration did too. 3 months later, Interior Secretary Gail Norton stood with Senator Gordon Smith in Klamath Falls and opened the irrigation system headgates that increased the water supply to 220,000 acres of farmland, a policy shift that continues to stir bitter criticism from environmentalists and Indian tribes. And by the way, I would add now here, 3 years later, we have seen that this policy that Rove engaged in led to the death of millions of salmon. In fact, last year they had to cut the salmon fishing season down to almost nothing here in the Pacific Northwest because of this action that Karl Rove took in order to help get, in part, in, I mean, nobody knows all the reasons, obviously, but in part because of this action that Karl Rove took in order to get Gordon Smith reelected to the Senate. As Tom Hamburger reports in the Wall Street Journal, though Mr. Rove's clout within the administration is often celebrated, this episode offers a rare window into how he works behind the scenes to get them done, to get things done. One of them is with periodic visits to cabinet departments. This is against the law! Over the past 2 years, Mr. Rove, or his top aide, Kenneth Melman, now manager of Mr. Bush's re-election campaign, have visited nearly every agency. That is, as in every federal agency, to outline White House campaign priorities, review polling data, and on occasion call attention to tight House, Senate, and gubernatorial races that may be affected by regulatory action. This is a crime. This is a clear and blatant violation of the Hatch Act. And today, this morning, right now, Tom Hamburger, the same guy who wrote that article for the Wall Street Journal back in July 30th of 2003, has a piece in today's Wall Street Journal, today's Los Angeles Times, in which he lays out, well, here it is. Most of the time, an obscure federal investigative unit known as the Office of Special Counsel confines itself to monitoring the activities of relatively low-level government employees, stepping in with reprimands and other routine administrative actions for such as offenses as discriminating against military personnel or engaging in prohibited political activities. But now, the Office of Special Counsel is preparing to jump into one of the most sensitive and politically explosive issues in Washington, launching a broad investigation into key elements of the White House political operations that for more than 6 years have been headed by Chief Strategist Karl Rove. Keep in mind, this is the same guy who wrote the article 3 years ago, laying out the details of exactly how this administration broke the law. The new investigation, Hamburger writes in today's Los Angeles Times, which will examine the firing of at least one U.S. attorney, missing White House emails, and White House efforts to keep presidential appointees attuned to Republican political priorities, could create a substantial new problem for the Bush White House. We will take the evidence where it leads us, says Scott Block, head of the Office of Special Counsel and a presidential appointee. He said, "We will not leave any stone unturned." This is all from an interview he gave just hours ago. You can find this over at latimes.com. And then they go through and they start quoting federal officials saying, "Yep, I was lobbied. I was, you know," just basically laying out Karl Rove's violation of the law. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Dreams of democracy, 21 minutes past the hour. A former Interior Department official, Wayne Smith, who sat through briefings from Rove, this is from Tom Hamburger's piece in today's Los Angeles Times, who sat through briefings from Rove and his then-deputy Ken Melman. Yes, that Ken Melman, the one who was later in charge of Bush's campaign in 2004, or in charge of the Republican Party, said that during President Bush's first term, he and other appointees were frequently briefed on political priorities. Said Smith, now this is a guy who worked for the Interior Department, "We were constantly being reminded about how our decisions could affect electoral results. This is against the law." You know what's particularly ironic here is that the Hatch Act came out of Republicans in 1938 complaining that WPA money, the Works Progress Administration, the WPA was an agency, it was one of several agencies, one of these, you know, triple alphabet agencies, the CCC and whatnot. The WPA was the Civilians Conservation Corps and the Works Progress Administration, whatnot, that were condemned by Republicans, by and large, as make-work agencies, where Americans who were unemployed were given jobs. The federal government became the employer of last resort. They were given jobs doing everything from building bridges and irrigation systems to planting forests to, in some cases, even, you know, hire poets to write poetry, hire artists to do art. Some of that art is the Detroit Art Institute, for example, one of my favorite around the country, has a huge and extraordinary collection of WPA art and art from that era that was funded by the federal government. Some just extraordinary stuff that came out of that. But in any case, what was happening was that there was concern among Republicans in Congress. The WPA money was being used, that basically, you know, people were being given jobs and that giving them jobs would cause them to think favorably of Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats, and thus their votes were being bought implicitly. And so the Republicans just were raising hell about this in the late 30s. And as a result of this, a Democratic senator from Tennessee, a fellow by the name of Hatch, oddly enough. I don't recall his first name, but in any case, Senator Hatch says, "Let's make this against the law. If you guys are right, you know, if there's corruption going on, whether it's in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, it's wrong. Let's make this against the law." And so he proposed legislation to say that people who held federal office could not use that federal office for political purposes, period. The Hatch Act has been challenged before the Supreme Court twice, both times people saying, "Hey, my First Amendment right of free speech allows me to do whatever I damn well please, even if I'm a federal employee." And both times the Supreme Court has said, "No, sorry, we're not talking about free speech here. We're talking about the misuse of federal office." As Tom Hamburger writes, the 106-person Office of Special Counsel has never conducted such a broad and high-profile inquiry in its history. although it really only has three jobs, and one of them is to enforce the Hatch Act. Block, again, from the Los Angeles Times, Block said the new investigation grew from two narrower inquiries his staff had begun in recent weeks. I would ask where they were in 2003 when Tom Hamburger wrote the first piece for the Wall Street Journal. But, you know, we'll cut him some slack, I guess. Everybody was giving the Bush administration slack in 2003, weren't they? Block said the new investigations grew from these two narrower inquiries. One involved the fired U.S. attorney from New Mexico, David Iglesias. The other centered on a PowerPoint presentation that J. Scott Jennings, a Rove aide, made at the General Services Administration this year. Well, hey, he got away with it at the Interior Department back in 2002. Why not just keep on doing it? What we have here is a fairly measurable, in my opinion, series of crimes under the Hatch Act by this administration. And I mean, just as a beginning point, there's a whole bunch of different crimes that this administration has committed that lead directly to the conclusion that maybe we should be, not maybe, that we should be, A, seriously investigating these guys. And Henry Waxman, God bless him, has got, like a pit bull, has got himself attached to the pant leg of some of these folks, and he's not going to let go. And the same with Pat Leahy in the Senate Judiciary Committee, Henry Gonzalez in the House Judiciary Committee. And there's a variety of them, House Oversight Committee. And frankly, John Conyers has been rather low profile in all this. I'm waiting to hear more from him in the House Judiciary Committee. But the bottom line is, these guys have been getting away with blatant violations of a variety of laws for the last 5.5-6 years. And now they're being called to account. I think, you know, it's high time. What's going to be particularly interesting is to see if the corporate media picks this up, A, and if so, how they spin it. How is this going to be spun on all the right-wing talking heads on television? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Pat Tillman's family testifying before the House of Representatives right now. And Jessica Lynch saying, I don't know why they lied about me to turn me into a media star. She doesn't get it. Well, I think the rest of us do. It's all about selling a war that was based on lies. And once you start a war based on lies, you got to maintain it based on lies. And when your poster boy for recruiting for the war is accidentally killed, tragically killed, and, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that it was accidental. I know that there's a whole collection of conspiracy theories around the fact that Pat Tillman was speaking out loudly. He was in Afghanistan speaking out loudly against the war in Iraq. And there are some people who think that therefore he was killed. I'm not ready to go there. But no matter what, I mean, A, the problem was solved of Pat Tillman being an opponent of the Iraq war, and B, the problem was solved of, you know, a terrible accident, assuming that that's what it was. And as I said, I'm prepared to believe that friendly fire does happen, and it happens with terrible regularity in war. Another reason why war should be the choice, the last option. His family testifying before Congress now. But the I think this is the biggest story of the day, that finally what Gordon Smith had done for him here in Oregon. We were witnesses to this, or at least I was living in Vermont at the time, but the good citizens of Oregon, I've lived here for 2 years, good citizens of Oregon were witnesses to this in 2002, to Karl Rove and George Bush and Gale Norton coming out here and taking water out of a river and using it to irrigate 220,000 acres of farmland to make the farmers happy, to buy their votes. And who gets screwed? About 120 fishing families. And they knew it wouldn't kill the fish. It wouldn't kill the salmon immediately. It would take a couple of years. Because what's going to happen is as the water flow decreases, the temperature of the streams increases, and you end up with the fish not being able to go up the river in order to spawn, and the babies not being able to go, the fingerlings not being able to go down the river. Just the whole cycle gets interrupted, and sure enough, last year, the salmon run was just totally screwed up. In the Columbia, and the Willamette, and in the Klamath, throughout in the entire basin. Because those fish, those little baby fish, never made it out to the ocean in the first place, or made it into the Columbia River. So Gordon Smith was elected in large part with the help of Karl Rove, George W. Bush, and Gale Norton in violation of federal law. And obviously he did nothing to stop it. He was apparently quite enthusiastic about it. But now the Office of Special Counsel, which only has three jobs, one of them to enforce the Hatch Act, is looking into this. What's the old saying? You never know what it is that's gonna end your life or whatever. There's some old cliche about that, but it's always something you don't expect. This, although you would think that they would have known right from the get-go, but Rove and Bush and Norton and others, I mean, throughout all the agencies, Karl Rove has made this PowerPoint presentation, these PowerPoint presentations in every major federal agency. He had to know what the Hatch Act was. It's mind-boggling. Justin in Seattle. Hey, Justin, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, thanks again for a great program. I guess I'm curious, as I imagine many listeners are, what particular or unique rules govern administration officials when it comes to having broken the law? It seems reasonable that if investigative reporter here in Seattle did a full research on me and came up with connecting the dots that I'd broken some white-collar law, some policeman would come to the door issuing a warrant, and I'd be investigated. Right. But yeah. Who, what jurisdiction governs administration officials? What policeman, who can send a policeman to Karl Rove's door and say, hey, we've got evidence that you broke this law. We'd like you to come in to court.
Because it's a federal law, it would be the Justice Department, which means Alberto Gonzalez. Justin?
Congress can send a U.S. Marshal to his door.
No. Congress has no police powers outside of a small congressional police staff. They have Congress has a police department that looks over their own buildings, and that's it. The equivalent for Congress of the Secret Service for the president. They basically have their own small police force that maintains order inside the congressional buildings. And that's why there was all that furor when the FBI went into Congressman Jefferson's office and took out his computers and things. Because if it's a crime, the FBI should have gone to the congressional police and said, we think this guy committed a crime. Here's the warrant. Please execute it. And they would have. There is a boundary there. Congress doesn't have the power to enforce their police on the executive branch. The executive branch doesn't have the police power to enforce their police power on the legislative branch. That's something that the founders put into the Constitution for a very clear purpose.
Like, if there were something like a hit and run where witnesses saw Karl Rove hit somebody, run him over, and drive away, the Washington, D.C. Police Department would have no authority over that.
No, they would. If it was done out, if it was in public and in Washington, D.C., and it wasn't a violation of a federal law, it was a violation of a Washington, D.C. municipal law or a state of Maryland law or state of Virginia law or whatever. In that case, then those local authorities would have power. But the Hatch Act is a federal law, so it has to be enforced by federal law enforcement officials. And the chief federal law enforcement official in the United States right now is Alberto Gonzalez.
So they can get away with anything as long as they have Alberto in their pocket.
Well, to a large extent, which is another reason why I think Bush is keeping him in place. Now, if the Office of Special Counsel decides, if this guy, Scott Block, who is the head of the Office of Special Counsel, decides that a crime has been committed and asks for an indictment of Karl Rove, then, you know, I believe he can convene a federal grand jury and they can hand down an indictment. But still, in order for that indictment to be prosecuted, if my understanding of this process is correct, and I think it is, although let me give you the caveat, I'm not an attorney. But my understanding is that in order for that to be successfully prosecuted, it's still going to have to be run through the Justice Department. But at the same time, there are a lot of good people in the Justice Department. There are a lot of career officials in the Justice Department, and there is a certain gag threshold. You know, I mean, there is a certain point after John Mitchell left the Justice Department, you know, way back during the Nixon administration. What was it? Ruckelshaus replaced him, as I recall. I may be wrong, but in any case, there's a certain point where people inside the Justice Department say, sorry, we're just not going to go along with this anymore. You know, we're going to do our job. We don't want to be the next ones going to jail. So that's how it works, Justin. Thanks a lot for the call. It's a very good one. Dennis in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, you think that Bill Clinton's worse than this guy?
Of course he is. I mean, gosh, you think about it, the attorney generals. Remember Janet Reno, for God's sakes? I mean, her bad judgments actually killed people. Remember Waco?
Down in Waco. Sure, I was no fan of Janet Reno's activities in Waco. By the way, the Waco, you will recall, the Waco standoff was initiated by whom? Dennis?
Who was it initiated by whom?
Right. Right. Who initiated the Waco standoff?
Well, it was a radical religious nut down there.
That's right, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Oh, God.
George Herbert Walker Bush. It was under his administration that the initial standoff at Waco was initiated. Janet Reno followed through on it. That's not to justify what she did. I think it's absolutely wrong. But your point, if you want to go back and say, oh, well, you know, Clinton did bad things or Janet Reno did bad things, therefore we should ignore crimes in this administration. You know, I mean, we can go all the way back to George Washington and find presidents that have done bad things. It doesn't mean that you don't prosecute crimes, particularly crimes that have to do with trying to usurp the power of government and create what's essentially a Stalinist rule, a single-party rule in this country. And Karl Rove has been unambiguous about this right from the get-go. He's been saying right from the very beginning that his goal is to create what he refers to as, using Karl Rove's words, a permanent Republican majority. That is referred to in other countries as single-party rule. That's what, you know, in Tripoli, that's what you have, you know, with Mr. Gaddafi. You have single-party rule. It's what you have in Egypt, single-party rule. It's what you have in Saudi Arabia, single-party rule. It's what you had in the Soviet Union, single-party rule. And that's what these guys are trying to create. Chris in Dublin, California. Hey, Chris.
Tom, how you doing? Hey, listen to your show a lot, and usually I'm really impressed by your knowledge of things, but I think you're missing a point here on this Hatch Act, and that's that these laws that the Republicans, they enact, they're not supposed to apply to them.
I see.
You know, all this ethics reform, you know, that the Congress went through, that wasn't supposed to apply to Tom DeLay.
Well, and in fact, none of it did until they started losing power. That's the amazing thing about elections where Democrats get power, is that all of a sudden the laws suddenly are being enforced. What a novel idea.
Well, and just for 1 minute, I want to just kind of issue a theory here, sort of playing devil's advocate. I think it's arguable that the amount of executive power grab has been unprecedented during this administration. And I wonder, I'd like to pose a theoretical question to a Republican. How are you going to feel when you're not in the executive anymore? How are you going to feel when there's a Democrat in there who you loathe much who's going to have all the power?
Yeah, it's the Hillary Clinton question. Do you really want to give this much power to President Hillary Clinton? And their answer is no. We'll take the power away the day George leaves office, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
want it. I ain't keeping score. I use the same person that was here before. Is it something important? Maybe not. Why was it you want it? Tell me again, I forgot.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat up at the top of the page. It's free and fun and live, and you get to interact with some of the finest minds in the entire planet. And pretty soon we'll have a link off AirAmerica.com as well for that. John in Mill Valley, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I quickly want to say my take on the takeover in Waco, the assault in Waco, was that in November of 92, when Bush, when Clinton was elected, by December of 92, there was talk of closing down the BATF to save money and condense it into the FBI as a cost-cutting measure, and that...
this all during the Bush senior administration.
Right, but as Clinton was coming in,
right, but he had
I thought it was a
he had no power. The actual, if you go back and you look at the history of this thing, the ATF's original plan for surveillance, the actual surveillance of the Branch Davidian compound started in the fall of 92.
Yeah.
Under the Bush administration and, uh-huh. and the Bush ATF and the Bush FBI.
Right.
And with these 30-year-olds who were calling themselves college students. And that's what made David Koresh crazy. And Clinton was sworn into office in January of 93. The ATF, before he was sworn into office, had planned a March 1st, 93 raid on Waco. It was already planned. And Janet Reno comes into office and they say, here's what we're going to do. We think this is a great idea. And she says, okay, do it, which is really stupid, and in my opinion. But, you know, that's what happened.
I thought that was a rogue maneuver by the ATF. And when they promoted the director to a high position in the FBI, I thought that was a reward to the BATF for a job well messed up.
Well, it's a possibility. I'm not a scholar of the Waco disaster. I am familiar with that the timeline of when the initial decisions were made. And,
right.
And people love to call up and blame Janet Reno and Bill Clinton for it. And it's sort of like blaming Jack Kennedy for the Bay of Pigs. Yeah, it was screwed up, but the Bay of Pigs was something that Richard Nixon put together in 1960. It was supposed to be an October surprise. He was going to invade Cuba in October of 1960 in order to win the election. For a variety of reasons, including weather, he couldn't pull it off, and so Jack Kennedy inherited this operation. Waco is not that different from that. Although, again, as I said, Kennedy blew it with the Bay of Pigs, and Clinton blew it, and Reno blew it with Waco. But let us not divert ourselves here from the issue of clear, and thank you for the call, of clear crimes being committed by Karl Rove in the White House. Jack in San Diego, you have some information about Congress I don't?
Well, I want to get your opinion on the interpretation of Article 1, Section 8. I believe it's the 15th paragraph. If Congress may have greater police power than you think, I don't know if they've ever exercised this part of the Constitution, but it states to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union.
Right, but that is
seems
an
to suggest
actual
that
militia.
Congress could call up the militia.
Right, but see, we no longer have a militia. I mean, that
well, today back, that means the National Guard.
Right, and in the years since that time, I mean, there's been some substantial reorganizing of militias. There was a series of them in the 30 years following the ratification of the Constitution, and then there was another one after the Civil War, along with Posse Comitatus, and the militias basically became National Guards and state forces. And only could be called up by the federal forces, with an executive order or in time of emergency. So to put a fine point on what you suggest, and I suppose you could probably argue this in a court, if the federal government, if the president, it would have to come from the president, if the president or if a governor decided that they wanted to call up a militia to arrest Karl Rove for what he's doing, on behalf of Congress. Maybe it could be done, but I don't think that...
Well, I've got a suggestion.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's a big controversy here in San Diego County. Blackwater wants to develop a training camp here.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Right. Okay, well, I'm thinking we don't really want it here. Maybe they could relocate it to Washington, D.C., and Congress could have their own well-regulated militia. A little bit of humor there.
Yeah, yeah, black humor, grim humor. Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Liz in Manhattan. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, man?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Well, I really don't have a statement. Oh, I have tons of statements, but my reason for calling was more questions. All day today, everybody has mentioned this something about the whole Jessica Lynch deal being,
right.
To use a, you know, a blatant word, lie. I know as a normal person, I, you know, for some odd reason, follow the whole thing of the capture, the rescue, the whole nine yards, and it looked real to me, and I was wondering what was the lie? How is it being coupled with Tillman?
Sure. The coupling with Tillman is that they were both PR stunts by the Army that were based in lies. Jessica Lynch was with a group that got lost, basically, and her truck drove into a ditch, and she was injured in the truck rolling over. She was then rescued by a group of Iraqis and taken to a local hospital where she was provided with medical aid and assistance. She was never engaged in a firefight. She never shot her weapon. Nobody shot at her. What we were told was that she had been wounded in combat, that she had valiantly resisted the bad guys, and that she was being basically held captive, when in fact the Iraqis who were holding her were helping her. They were rescuing her and providing her with medical services. And we sent in basically a military SWAT team to take her out of there, and they videotaped the whole thing. They went in with video cameras so that the RNC could use that footage and the Pentagon could use that footage and say, oh, we've rescued this poor girl, and it was the whole archetypal story, you know, the whole paternalistic story of George Bush. He's the big daddy, and he's helping this poor little, fairly attractive young lady, you know, which doesn't hurt the story at all, right? You know, rescue the damsel in distress. Rescuing her was a fine thing, but the story was so heavily embellished with lies that it's enough. 57 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Welcome back. So yesterday I get an email and then a call from Fox News. They're going to have a discussion on the immigration issue this morning and are looking for a liberal who will suggest that. Now, these are my words, not theirs. This is just the gist of the conversation. A liberal who would say that basically all illegal immigrants in the United States should have instant citizenship or amnesty, that would support amnesty. And I said, sorry, I'm not in that camp. Like the progressive position since the 1880s, and arguably before that. In fact, I suppose arguably you could say that the Native American progressive position is, who are these European immigrants, these illegal Europeans here? But the progressive position has been, if you don't control the supply of labor, then the price of labor is going to collapse. And if the price of labor collapses, you won't have a middle class anymore. You'll have the working poor. You're going to be back to Dickensian economics. And so because I didn't want to take a kind of loony liberal position, I guess, in their minds, they went off looking for somebody else. My position is that we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem. And I believe that Don Goldwater, Barry Goldwater's nephew, chairman of the Legal Arizona Workers Act, legalarizonaworkers.com, and the website Arizona Grassroots, azgrassroots.com, may agree with me. I'm not sure. Don, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Good to see you. Good to talk to you. I appreciate you having me on. And, yeah, I do agree with you on a couple aspects. On the immigration issues, we do have to go after the employers who knowingly hire illegal aliens and make it so intrusive that they don't do it.
This is, you know, the metaphor that I use for this, and I think it's a fairly clean one, and it's one that every country in the world understands, including Mexico. If I try to go down to work in Mexico without a work permit, they will prosecute me. They will expel me. I mean, they have very, very strong immigration laws in Mexico. And right. Virtually every other country in the world. I lived in Germany for a year. It took me 6 months just to get a work visa before I went.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. And the metaphor that I use is one of membranes. An organism, our organisms always have membranes. We, you know, you and I have skin. It's the boundary of our bodies. There must be a membrane in order to maintain homeostasis, in order to maintain balance. And in order for a country to have an economy which is economically in balance, where the supply of labor and the demand for labor are relatively equal, there must be some control over the amount of labor. And frankly, the history of progressive movements and the history of the labor movement until 2000, when, in my opinion, the labor unions basically sold out, was to say that they wanted to limit the supply of labor in order to drive up the price of labor so that a middle class could emerge. That's what unionization was all about. That's what the work against the child labor laws, in favor of child labor laws, against child labor was all about, because child labor was being used to bust up to drive down the cost of adult labor. And Don, what gets me, and I'll tell you, back in 64 when I was 13 years old, I went door to door for your uncle. And 3 years later, I was out with SDS on the streets, in total opposition to your uncle's position. So I've been on both sides of this, I suppose, of the left, right, as it were. And I proudly consider myself a progressive and a liberal. So many of your friends who consider themselves conservatives, and I believe that that's the position or the label that you would probably proudly attach to yourself, will not talk about employers because they are so in bed with or so in love with the idea of big corporations ultimately running America. Let's privatize Social Security, let's privatize healthcare, let's privatize everything, and just let the big corporations run everything. And if it's profitable for them, then that's a good thing, and cheap labor is profitable for them.
Well, I think you're right on the money that you have to follow the money to understand the immigration issue. If you look at campaigns, be it liberals, conservatives, whatever, most of their funding comes from Washington D.C., from the Beltway in there. The average congressional campaign, you're looking at probably about 10 to 15% total funding coming from that person's state, and the rest coming from the lobbyist issues out there. You know, the people of the United States love legal immigrants. We all started off as other than Native Americans, we all started off as legal immigrants here. What we tolerate is people coming into our country illegal, breaking the laws, stealing identities so that they can get a job, coming in, driving down the wage price of the issue, and then using more from government services than what they put back in. You look at the Heritage
Foundation. Don, we're talking with dude Don Goldwater, azgrassroots.com. This is probably where you and I part company. I agree with you that those things are all social ills. I don't see those as the problem. I don't think that the vast majority of those things would happen if we did not have illegal employers in the United States. We've had a border with Mexico for a couple of hundred years, or arguably since the Mexican-American War, and what was it, the 1840s, late 1840s?
Sure.
I mean, we've had that border, and it has been absolutely wide open and unprotected, and people from Mexico, you know, every year maybe a million people will come north, and they'll do labor, you know, mostly migrant farm labor, but even during the Great Depression, there was very little of that because so many Americans were doing migrant farm labor. An old friend of mine, Dennis Weaver, just recently died. His family moved from Oklahoma up to Oregon to pick strawberries, you know,
I don't think you and I are all that much off apart. I think the issue here is that you've got to stop the demand.
That's my point. Is the day that we start putting CEOs in prison and we start giving the death penalty to corporations and saying, sorry, you can no longer do business because you're not doing business in a way that's consistent with the laws of this country, is the day that this stops. And in that regard, this is one of the questions that Fox News put to me last night, is will you support Gavin Newsom in San Francisco in saying that he will not enforce federal laws, you know, that are going against illegal immigrants? And I'm really of two minds about that. On the one hand, if somebody's hungry, they should be fed. If somebody's sick, they should be given medical care, period. I don't care about their immigration status. On the other hand, if an employer continues to draw people by offering jobs to people who are not citizens, I think that employer should be put in jail. I don't think we need a fence, and I don't think we need buses to deport people. If you no longer offer people jobs, they don't come and they will leave.
And let's go back to the basis of the beginning and define what a person is who is here illegally. And it's very, very simple. A person who is here illegally is a person without a country, because their home country does not want to put an economy together to support the people in their native land. And the people of the United States, by far polling, do not want these people here illegally. So these people.
Well, now hang on just a second, Don. There are many people who would argue that the reason why people are coming here from Mexico specifically is because we have been subsidizing the price of corn to the point where indigenous farmers, local farmers, small farmers in Mexico can no longer make a living. They get driven off their land. They're in despair. Their kids are hungry. I mean, we're talking actually starvation in some places.
Actually, that's
and
not,
so they
that's
end
not
up
exactly
here.
True right now with the price of ethanol and the demand on corn. There's huge demonstrations in Mexico
in the last
right
2 years
because people can't afford tortillas because the price of corn has gone up. So it's helped the farmers.
Okay, well, over the last 2 years. No, but my point is that I don't think that we can ever point to one thing. But the thing is that, you know, on the conservative side. But on the conservative side, there is this instant tendency to point at the individual rather than at the institutions. And what I want to salute you for doing is openly and aggressively suggesting that employers should be put in jail.
Well,
I have not heard this from any other conservatives.
Let me get
say what?
Straight. We don't want to put them in jail because we don't think that does anything. What our bill does.
Well, in that case, then I disagree with you.
What our initiative does is this. It says, okay. If you knowingly hire an illegal alien, and you are found to have knowingly hired an illegal alien, then you lose your ability to do business in the state of Arizona forever. Putting the president or the CEO in jail, we feel, is not going to do anything to deter the big corporation, because they'll just go out and hire another president or CEO.
Oh, come on. Come on, Don. You know better than that.
But if you have a company like a Circle K or a Hilton or whatever company that's out there that is found to knowingly hire illegal aliens, and you yank their business license and no longer allow them to do business in the state of Arizona, they will think twice about hiring that person because of all the investment they have in the property in that state, all the investment they have on the potential income coming into the state. We think that's a stronger bill.
I'll give it to you that that's a good starting point. But at the same time, I think that what we need to have in the United States right now is an honest discussion, setting aside all the demagoguery, all the nonsense about, you know, terrorists coming in and all this other stuff, about immigration, because we should have legal immigration into the United States.
Legal being the word.
Don, we have to wrap it up. LegalArizonaWorkers.com and AZGrassroots.com. Don Goldwater, thanks for being with us today, Don.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
21 minutes past the hour. Let me just lay this out really simply. David Ricardo laid it out in 1816 in a paper he wrote called On Labor. It's Economics 101. Ricardo pointed out that a middle class is not a normal thing. It's not a normal thing to have people to essentially to have a middle class. What is normal is to have people, is to have a large class of the working poor. The only way a middle class happens is when the demand for labor slightly exceeds the supply of labor. And thus drives up the cost of labor. You had a middle class emerge in Europe in the 1400s after the Black Death, after the bubonic plague, and it led to the Renaissance. You had a middle class emerge in Europe in the 1600s as a consequence of all the gold that was being looted from the natives in America, particularly Central and South America. And it led to the Enlightenment. These were abnormal events that threw the economy out of balance into a way that produced a middle class. You had a middle class in the United States in the 1700s because of the theft of basically free land and natural resources from Native Americans by Europeans. And then the United States went through a period from about the 1830s or 1840s until the 1930s when outside of farm families and the occasional shop owner or butcher, baker, candlestick maker, the mercantile class, outside of a very small number of people and a large number of farmers in the early years, there was no middle class. In 1900, when Teddy Roosevelt, you know, 1901, when Teddy Roosevelt became president, the average income of the American worker in today's dollars was $9,700 a year. You had a huge class of the working poor. And so to limit the supply of labor, a whole variety of things were done, including immigration laws, child labor laws, and the ability to unionize so that workers themselves could limit access to the supply of labor on the part of employers, thus driving up the cost of labor. And that produced one of the largest, most powerful middle classes the world had ever seen in the United States in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s as Ronald Reagan began to take it apart. And what we have now is a Bush administration that wants to reinstitute the Bracero program, essentially a slave labor program where employers will have the power to deny people the ability to eventually get citizenship. I mean, we need to have an honest and candid conversation about this in this country without any finger pointing and without any demagoguery. We have a lot of people in this country who are partial families, people who have come to this country and had children. You've got kids who are 16, 17, 18, 20 years old who were born here, but whose parents weren't, but they're here. What are you going to do? Tear those families apart? Obviously not. I mean, it would be inhuman. You've got people who need services. At the same time, you've got an entire corporate class that is just salivating at the idea of cheap labor. And then on the third hand, to add to that, you've got the situation in many countries south of our border where corrupt oligarchies and corrupt right-wing governments, and we just saw this in Mexico, are being propped up by the fact that many of the people who have the enthusiasm, the energy, the willingness to take risks and get out there and work hard and do the things necessary to build a country have left their country to come here looking for jobs. And as a result, there's not the political foundation for any kind of progressive future. There's a reason why countries have borders and have immigration policies. Frankly, we need more immigrants in the United States, more legal immigrants in the United States, in a whole variety of areas. And I've seen all sides of this. My sister-in-law is a legal immigrant to the United States. She is not yet a citizen. She's been working on it for, 4 years now, going on 5, I think. On my mother's side, my family came here in the 1600s. I mean, James Madison's brother is one of my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. On my father's side, both my father's mother and father, my grandparents, both came here in 1917 from Norway. They were immigrants, legal immigrants to the United States. So, I mean, I've seen this from every side. I have done migrant farm work. Yes, I had the luxury of being, you know, a white college kid back in the 60s doing it, but it was one of the ways that I saved enough money to go to school, was picking apples in northern Michigan up in White Cloud, Michigan. The point is that what we need, and that there is no such thing as a job that Americans won't do if it pays well, number one. That's the number one conservative lie. And number two, that the conservatives have been using this strategy of divide and conquer, of trying to pit us against each other, of trotting out the old racist canards. Oh, my God, there's brown people coming. There might be Muslim terrorists sneaking in among them. And let's give another billion-dollar contract to Halliburton to build a wall or Bechtel. I mean, it's all nonsense. It's all demagoguery. 27 minutes past the hour. Your thoughts next.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Looking at the wire services, as they say in the news business, of all the strange things going on there, in a strategic alliance that combines two core elements of the GOP base, the National Rifle Association and the pro-life movement have joined forces to support the arming of all fetuses with handguns. Both groups are trying to exploit the recent tragedy of Virginia Tech, as well as the Supreme Court's ruling on partial birth abortion, to mount the most aggressive defense yet of the so-called unborn. NRA President Wayne LaPierre stated that merely forcing a pregnant woman to repeatedly watch her own sonogram is not a sufficient deterrent to abortion, but if a 9-week-old fetus is packing a 9mm handgun, that'll make her think twice. Randall Terry, the Right to Life activist who founded Operation Rescue, added, "If Jane Roe's fetus had been armed back in 73, old Jane wouldn't have been standing, let alone had standing, to make her case before the Supreme Court." Claiming that a pregnant woman should not be the only one with a right to carry, both groups have also proposed amending the Second Amendment to say a well-regulated womb as being necessary to the subjugation of women. The right of the fetus to keep and bear arms, particularly concealed weapons, shall not be infringed. Democrats, reluctant to take on both the gun and the right-to-life lobbies in light of next year's presidential election, have decided not to oppose an outright ban on handguns for fetuses. Instead, they plan to introduce legislation requiring a 9-month waiting period. That from satiricalpolitical.com, by the way, Don Davis's piece. So, a little bit of levity there. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dan in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you're familiar with H.R. 1645, the Flight v. Terror's immigration bill?
I confess I am not.
It's a nightmare concoction from a corporate libertarian Republican and a Reconquista Democrat. It basically gives all corporations a free pass as far as employing illegals. It gives companies the right to fire American workers and hire who they want without any
consequences. By and large, what you're describing, Dan, is the current state of affairs.
There's no law enforcement, but this is making it legal.
Right. That's incredible. And thanks for the heads up on that, Dan. What's amazing to me is I will say, and I do, that I think that virtually every country in the world has immigration laws, and there's a reason for that. There's a variety of reasons for that. And most of those reasons, frankly, don't have to do with security. They have to do with economics, and that the United States should too. And people immediately go, oh, you're one of those guys. You want to build a fence. No, I think a fence is a stupid idea. Oh, you must be one of those guys. You don't want people immigrating from south of here. No, I think we should have many more legal immigrants from south of here. And frankly, from other places where there are crises. We've got people standing in line to be legal immigrants to the United States from countries where if they stay in those countries, they are going to be tortured, they're going to be murdered, they're going to be the victims of genocide. I think we should increase our immigration quotas, our legal immigration quotas, and we should streamline the process. And I'm telling you, I've seen that process. I'm one of those people who has written letters on behalf of legal immigrants and shown up and testified on behalf of legal immigrants in the United States. So it's just incredible. It's like, you know, when Fox News contacted me yesterday, you're a liberal. Therefore, your position must be that there should be no borders. No, that's not my position. I think every country has to have its own economic and political homeostasis. It's very simple. James in New Paul's, New York. Hey, James.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to talk about something I had posted on your blog, and actually you alluded to it. There's an organization called Oxfam that came out with a report a few years ago, and it talked about the relationship between the corn subsidies we've sent to Mexico and the immigration it's caused. And according to this report, since 1994, U.S. exports of corn to Mexico have increased by over 70%. The price of corn in Mexico has declined by 70%, and this has affected some 15 million agricultural workers in Mexico. Mexico still does a lot of hand labor. It's not
right, and therefore the people in Mexico should be standing up to their government and saying, pass a tariff law, pass a duty law, get out of NAFTA right now, and pass a duty law that will protect Mexican farmers, rather than trying to come to the United States and get a job as a carpenter.
Yeah, I agree.
And the fact that we say, hey, come on here, you know, our employers will hire you because you're cheaper than Americans, and therefore it drives down the cost of labor for everybody. It takes the political pressure off the government in Mexico, which is a bad thing, mm-hmm. and it destroys the American middle class, which is a bad thing. Yeah. I agree with you that the corn subsidies are a terrible thing, and that our export policies have been driving, you know, awful things in other countries. But those countries have an obligation, the people in those countries have an obligation, just like we do, to stand up to our government and say, no, these insane trade policies, I don't care how many books Tom Friedman sells, these insane trade policies are wrong.
I agree with you, but I just wish that this would come into the debate.
I brought it into the debate with Don Goldwater, but he also, you know, he threw it back. I mean, his point is right. Right now they're actually having riots in some parts of Mexico because the price of corn in the last 2 years has gone up so dramatically because of ethanol. That argument that Oxfam makes is right. And it's somewhat limited. I mean, that dynamic is changing, and people still want to come to America and get a job. And so, you know, it's really only part of the equation. I mean, there's a whole lot of other things, too. I mean, we were supporting death squads down in Central America back 15, 20 years ago. We still are in Colombia. And that causes, you know, displacing farmers and causing people to come up here. We're defoliating land in Peru and in Colombia. I mean, there's no end to the little shop of horrors that the conservatives running this government and frankly, past administrations have foisted on people to the south of us that would, you know, if I was a citizen down there, I'd be saying, I'm getting out of here. Sure. But what we want to encourage them to, or, you know, not that it's our business, right? Let's not be paternalistic about this, what ultimately should be happening, and frankly is happening in Chile, in Argentina, in Brazil, it just happened in Ecuador, and in Venezuela, is that the people of the country are saying, no, we're going to elect a government that's actually going to represent us, not the ruling oligarchy, not the wealthy, not the former Coca-Cola executive like Vicente Fox, who you know, was in bed with the 34 families, the 38 families that basically own Mexico. David in Phoenix. Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Hartman? First-time listener, I want to let you know. I have a comment about your conversation with Mr. Goldwater.
Yes,
first of all, briefly, let me tell you, I have experience firsthand on what happens with illegal immigration. Born and raised in Pennsylvania, moved out here before I went to college. I applied for a job at a restaurant, okay? Long story short, I was working in the restaurant. The guy offered to pay me under the table, and I refused to take it. I didn't want to do it, but what happened was he ended up, you know, because in the kitchen I knew that there were a lot of illegals that were receiving money under the table. And he wanted me to go ahead and accept this money under the table, but I refused to accept it. Now, the comment I want to really make is when I hear someone like Mr. Goldwater say that employers should not be, you know, punished to the max, I mean, it's frustrating to me because, like I said, I've experienced this employer. I had to lose my job. I was only a young kid, 18 years old at the time. You know, I had to lose my job just because of the simple fact that I wouldn't do like the illegals that were working inside the kitchen did. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I absolutely, David, I absolutely get your point, and yeah, right on. Well said. David, thank you very much. Dave in San Diego, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Thompson? Hartman, sorry about that.
That's okay.
I just had a comment about the interview that you just had with Mr. Goldwater. And, you know, I think that you really do need to consider his point that, you know, corporations, they really aren't too concerned about being held criminally liable for their actions, and that pretty much their only concern is the bottom line of their company. And that's really what, in reality, what we're going to have to go after.
Well, Dave, I will give you that the bottom line is important to corporations, but when the law changed last year, the Securities and Exchange Commission laws changed so that if executives participate, if the CEO of a company signed off on the balance sheet of that company and it turned out that the balance sheet contained Enron-style numbers, that guy could go to jail. All of a sudden, there was a whole new industry developed of CPAs who were double-checking those numbers to make sure that they were actually accurate. And now investors have a somewhat higher level of security in knowing that they're not putting money into an Enron-style company. The threat of jail actually does work, and it just boggles my mind that conservatives who are all gung-ho to throw illegal immigrants in jail, who are all gung-ho to have Halliburton build more prisons, let's have Marriott build more prisons, the CEOs, no, we wouldn't want to do that. Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Bernice, got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I have two quick points. One, and I won't talk about this a lot, is that what's not been discussed enough, in my opinion, is the children of undocumented immigrants, because that's a whole kind of separate issue.
Yeah, that's where I said, you know, that is, and it's one where we need to have an honest conversation about it. This is these are human beings as well.
Oh, God.
And a lot of them know nothing except English in America. And to simply say, okay, you're off to Mexico tomorrow, or your parents are off to Mexico and you're here with a foster parent, those are both equally unpalatable options.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the contribution that they can and are making, but they could make even much more to our society, is something
sure.
that we're not taking care
sure.
of.
Sure, let's just make sure that it's that there's a legal process in place.
Right. Second, and the DREAM Act, by the way, which was introduced by Orrin Hatch a couple years ago, is a good way to do that. But secondly, I believe, and the man that just called, not the one now, but one before, who said that, you know, he was asked to take money under the table.
Under the table.
He was such a good example of what I believe, that it's not an illegal immigration problem. I think it's a false perception of competition that's been
well
set
said,
up.
Bernice. Now, I say it's an illegal employer problem. We have illegal corporate behavior in this country, and that's what's driving all this. But thank you for your call. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
My apologies if that made it through out of the air there. Hopefully we bleeped that. I didn't realize there was an obscenity in that liner. Don in Kelso, Washington, welcome back to the program. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom, two things. In my younger years before I retired, I taught in South Texas on the border, and I got to know quite a few people who were coming across just to work in their conditions that they would describe. If you ever knew any of those people, you would understand why they do it. See, and I really think we're hitting the wrong people when we talk about some of the laws and actions that we're taking. You're absolutely right. We need to go after the people that are hiring, because there are no jobs. most of them won't come here. That's the only.
Yeah, exactly. And that will also create political pressure for reform in countries south of the border, which would be a desirable thing for them as well as for us.
Absolutely. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, earlier you were talking about the Office of the Special Counsel. Isn't there a committee in the House of Representatives that's charged with oversight of government operations? And why can't they go after these people and what they're doing?
They are. That's Henry Waxman's committee and the House Oversight and Governmental Affairs Committee in the House, as I recall the title of it. And he is. They're issuing subpoenas. They're doing a whole lot of this kind of stuff. And you know, God bless them, and may they do more. Don, thanks for the point, for the call, and for the point well made. Steve in driving in Tennessee. Hey, Steve, what's up? Steve? No, Steve. Let's go to Ralph in Colorado Springs. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah. Tom? Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, Ralph.
Yeah, my cat was out in the snow and complaining. I had to let him in.
I understand.
Yeah.
If Higgins was out in the snow, I would do the same.
Yeah, well, I would. Exactly. Yeah, very somber point, though. Bush lowers the flag to honor 32 killed at Virginia Tech. Now, he's never lowered the flag for any of 3,200 American troops killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Wouldn't it be a good idea for Congress in the war funding bill to require the flag be flown at half staff each day one of our troops is killed?
Yeah, it probably would, Ralph. Although it's, you know, the political reality is that it ain't going to happen, because Bush, that would require Bush to admit that his policies are failed and they're leading to deaths. But frankly, you think back during World War II, I don't believe that the flags were flown at half staff, even though we were having massive casualties. The difference is that this is an unjustified war. But the Bush administration is not going to you know, cop to that. But you know, your point is well made. The whole hypocrisy of it. Steve in Wisconsin. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great show. I just wanted to nitpick a little bit because I largely agree with what you're saying about the illegal. This is an illegal employer issue, not an illegal labor issue. But I think you're jumping to the slightly wrong conclusion because of the 19th century framework that you're using with Ricardo's theory of natural price of labor, which is basically a supply-demand way of looking at the price of labor. And, of course, in that framework, you have to limit the supply in order to drive up the price, right? And
or you increase demand.
Yes, yes. And
Which is the history of the Industrial Revolution, by the way.
Exactly, and that's what I was going to say, that increasing the demand would be another way to go, that is increasing the amount, the rate by which the economy turns out new jobs.
Right, but see, the way Steve, that you increase demand for labor in a particular country is by protecting the industries in that country. We don't make shoes in the United States anymore.
Not necessarily. You can.
No, I understand that. I'm not making this statement, Steve, as an absolute. I'm not saying that this is the only way. But the fact of the matter is that I can name 100 different products in the United States that we were making from 1776 up until 1995, and we no longer make in the United States, from shoes to televisions to computers, from steel to tool and die shops to chips that are used in our computer systems and our weapon systems for that matter. And none of those things are being made anymore, because we changed our trade policies. And
yes,
if you want to increase the demand for labor in this country, then you do away with trade policies that allow corporations to offshore or export that labor, that specific labor in that product, and require them to make the product in the United States. And you can do that in a variety of ways, from domestic content laws to tariff laws.
Tom, I understand the point, you made it very clearly, and I can understand how it looks like from the Bush economy standpoint. This is exactly where they are driving us. They are driving us back in a 19th century, rubber baron kind of capitalism, and that's how it looks like right now. But imagine for a second, and actually Joe Stiglitz and George Akerlof and got a Nobel Prize in 2001 for analyzing the information in the economy, and namely information asymmetries, and they found that if you eliminate these information asymmetries in a society, in the economy, then you're dramatically increasing the chance of, you know, getting more productive, getting more... Getting
over the short term, Steve. What you're doing is you're converting information into a commodity that's easily traded. And the manipulation of information, which is a form of labor, into a commodity that's easily traded.
Exactly,
I was in India back about 8-9 years ago when Microsoft was down there holding a hiring fair where they were hiring engineers for $10,000 a year. I was there in the country when that was happening. Big news, screaming headlines in the newspaper, tens of thousands of people going to Bangalore to apply for $10,000 a year jobs that would pay $120,000 a year in Seattle.
I completely agree, but the thing is that, you see, I'm not threatened by a software engineer in India because the Indian software engineer will come up with a new idea that will create two new jobs in a free, information
in India.
Playing field, but the problem
in India. No, Steve, I'm sorry. This Friedmanian theory of there's an infinite, everything is self-generative and it's infinitely growing. It just doesn't work. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Well, have the inmates taken over the asylum? Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Greg Palast in the studio with me, the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, his new book, New York Times bestseller, Armed Madhouse, from Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. Greg.
Nice title.
Yeah.
What is it?
This is brilliant. This is absolutely brilliant. So tell me about Karl Rove's reading list and why we should care about this.
Well, here's the weird one. Karl Rove has said, and by the way, you're really messing the man up, the poor man, because Karl Rove was gloating on a February 7th email. The House Judiciary Committee released, you know, like 2,000 of Rove and his minions' emails, and the whole team was gloating how that no U.S. media, national media, has picked up the investigations of that British reporter, Greg Palast.
Just because you report for the BBC.
Well, Mr. Rove, I'm an American. Greg Palast is an American, and you're un-American, see? and they actually attached...
Rove thinks he's dropped into the Twilight Zone.
They attached a PDF of an excerpt of Armed Madhouse, apparently they went through it, and then they had several emails screeching and providing their review.
Yeah.
So you've now broken the omerta. You are not supposed to have done this now. So yeah. We will now be at the Tom Hartman wing of at Guantanamo next year for the
God forbid. But the important point here, Greg, I mean, in all seriousness, is that these internal emails in the White House and Rove and all these guys being so pleased that no American media had the temerity to pick up this story that you have in your book, Armed Madhouse, now available in bookstores near you, and paperback today, that it's rolling out, that story is...
Okay, the particulars, they didn't like any of them, whether it was the Baghdad, New Orleans, Iraq, but they're particularly incensed as they were firing prosecutors about my discussion of the prosecutors. You know, I actually spoke to one of the characters in the book, David Iglesias, one of the guys who got axed.
Right.
Rove's minions were running around saying that there's voter fraud. While they are wiping out voters, they're accusing Democrats of floating in several Mexicans, I kid you not, 5 million illegal aliens to vote for Hillary Clinton while they're still wet.
Now they have successfully prosecuted 20 people in 6 years for voter fraud.
And at least
committed election fraud all across the country.
Maybe one of them was guilty, but that doesn't matter. That's quibbling. But, the thing is that Iglesias, I was told that Iglesias was prosecuting these guys. So I called him up. I called up his office and said, so you're prosecuting? Well. And I said, you're given names. Give me the names. In other words, they faked the evidence, didn't they? There is no prosecution. And he And there was silence. And I said, I'll take that as a yes. They just faked it. Unfortunately for Iglesias, Rove read our madhouse, the first edition. This is the new edition coming
out. He read your book.
He read it.
And he fired the
guy. And he had Iglesias, you know.
Bounce him out.
And,
yeah.
But the real one that they're very concerned about, where they went on and on for several emails, there's nothing worse than firing honest prosecutors except replacing them with crooks. Okay, I'm going to...
Let's see. Arkansas?
Arkansas. So what happens, one of the stories in the book that I go into, the new section, especially the theft of 2008, I figured I'd report it in advance, you know. For those who don't know Greg Palaszczuk, I'm the guy that did the story about, Catherine Harris knocked out tens of thousands of black voters before the 2000 race. They're calling them felons. Their crime was voting while black. But so in 2004, they improved it. What they did was that they sent out millions, literally millions of letters to voters, targeted voters, mostly minority black and brown voters. And if the letters came back, they would challenge their vote. Now, who were these ne'er-do-well voters? Soldiers was a big target group. In other words, and there's one guy, Randy Prowse, that we spoke with, or his family. I said, where's Randy? Is he at this address? It's a big challenge. He doesn't live at this address. Well, no, he's been sent overseas by his naval airmen, right? And his absentee ballot came in. It was challenged by the Republicans.
Is this the process called caging?
That's what we discovered, the caging.
And the Republican Party has, for over 20 years, been operating under a restraining order, a federal restraining order, preventing them from engaging in caging.
Well, are you accusing them of now breaking the law?
No, am I right on this?
Yeah, it's a felony crime.
It's my recollection that they've been under a federal court order.
That's right. And what happened was that Karl Rove sent me these emails that he was going to be knocking out these people. I kid you not. Of course, he didn't mean to. He had missed. These are not the sharpest knives in the drawer. They missent emails. They were gathered up by people who figured that Greg Palaszczuk could make some use of this. And BBC, we spent hundreds of person hours, digging through this stuff, plotting what is these caging lists that Rove and his people keep talking about. Caging lists.
Because they sent them to RNC.com when they meant RNC.org.
Yeah, it was
like
close
that.
To that, right? Bush.org. And so it was. So we got 500 of the emails. These are ones that judiciary is looking for. And
you have the emails that Congress 500, wants?
500 of them. Not all. They have like thousands, but I have 500. But these 500, according to Bobby Kennedy, an elections attorney, says this is going to jail, breaking rocks on a chain gang crime. What they did was they targeted hundreds of thousands of black folk because of their...
Now, was this Ken Melman or Terry Holt or Karl Rove
you're talking
George
about
W.
Rove,
Bush?
And in particular, the guy in charge of the whole business is a guy named Tim Griffin. You know what his job is today?
He's the federal prosecutor from Arkansas.
Bingo! You get a free copy of our madhouse. Yes, exactly. So what happens is that they're really very concerned because what I've done is we've exposed, and I work for BBC. He calls me British reporter because I work for BBC television. So what we exposed in Britain, and they're upset about it there, not here, is that
you've exposed a felony in the White House.
Yeah, the perpetrators are now the prosecutors. So that what they've done is they put in Griffin, who ran this scheme to wipe out the voters. Now, you have to understand, I mean, some of the things that we did, we had to check it out because BBC, we were concerned we were being planted with something. So we ended up going to Rove's office, getting kicked out, and then speak to some RNC flack. And we showed them these caging lists. We printed them out, some of them, thousands of names, hundreds of thousands of names. He said, what's this? Bush donors. Oh, those are donor lists. Page after page of men in homeless shelters.
Right.
And
African Americans have been sent over to Iraq.
And African American, go to Iraq, lose your vote, mission accomplished. And so
Greg, here's the $64,000 question. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about this several times on this program, and over a period of, what, 2-3 years we've been talking about this stuff? I mean, this book has been out for a year. We were talking about it before the book came out. This is not a secret. This is out there. Any idiot, I mean, even I'm so tempted to name names. Even idiots who work for major news networks could simply pick up a copy of your book, if not Armed Madhouse, available in bookstores nationwide.
That's what they were saying.
And why is it that not one single national major corporate-owned media outlet in the United States is telling the story that you just shared with me?
I'd like to know that so I wouldn't have to report from Britain and my kids wouldn't have British, sound like they're from upstairs, downstairs. Yeah. I mean, I'm in exile. And I have to say, by the way, Bobby Kennedy went to the head of ABC News and said, listen, you can get Greg's BBC reports for free. We have a film trading agreement. And basically, ABC News called me up and said, we just want to tell you, Greg, that, you know, we'll take your BBC reports. Never, ever, ever.
Do you think that Disney's ownership of ABC has anything to do with it?
No, but the guy talking to me had these weird big ears on and was... You know,
I mean, like, it's just, you know, I can get it with NBC, you know, GE is a defense contractor, you know,
that's the problem, is that you had, we were nailing this stuff about Iglesias, who's basically calling his boss a liar, they knock it out, then they put in the perpetrator, right. But that's just the beginning of the scheme, and then, you know, right. There's a lot of other stuff, you know, look, all this stuff ultimately is, investigative reporting may be dead in America, but once we do it, yeah, they have the right to simply use the film free. Now, of course,
and they won't. And they won't. I mean, this is incredible. What boggles my mind, I have heard at least 15 or 20 times in the last, and we have less than a minute left here, I've heard 15, 20 times on the talking heads on TV, there's no underlying crime here. Why are they going after Gonzalez? There's no underlying. There's a huge underlying crime here. And it's all in your book, Armed Madhouse.
These should be Breaker Rocks and Chain. You know, it's not just the elections thing. You have to understand. That's why I have the new chapter in there about New Orleans, about being busted by Homeland Security.
You were. Know? Oh, I remember. Yeah. You came on this program and you said, I'm going to go to jail.
And thank you, by the way. That really embarrassed them because that's why I'm not wearing an orange suit. You know?
Oh, that's great.
No, really, that made a huge difference. But the you know, it's look, the book is, people say, well, how can you make fun of all these serious things? Because it's like, these are truly armed, dangerous clowns.
Yeah, they truly are. And from Baghdad to New Orleans, sordid secrets and strange tales of a White House gone wild. It's Armed Madhouse, now available in paperback in fine bookstores everywhere and online, of course. GregPalast.com for the website if you want more information. Greg Palast, the New York Times bestselling author and one of the best investigative journalists in the world. Thanks, Greg, for being here.
The guy who sprung me.
There you go. 16 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Just a quick heads up, May 6th, 2007, May 6th, coming up here, the University of Judaism is going to be presenting a seminar titled The Impact of Talk Radio. I'll be on the panel along with Bill Handel of KFI, Doug McIntyre of KABC, and Dennis Prager, who's on KRLA, all in the L.A. area there. I mean, those are the local stations. And so the four of us are going to get together and rumble it up. It should be an interesting conversation. And you can find more information over at KTalk's website. 22 minutes past the hour. China on Monday has given this from the New York Times. This is really and truly mind-boggling. China on Monday has given American regulators permission to enter the country to investigate whether Chinese suppliers exported contaminated pet food ingredients to the United States earlier this year. And by the way, it's looking now like it might not just be pet food. It may also be livestock feed and may even, I mean, there's some concern that some of this contaminated wheat, rice, and perhaps some other types of protein, vegetable proteins, may have been contaminated with melamine in order to boost the amine content, the perceived protein content. Even including possibly foods that are being served to humans. But here's the kicker. The first sentence of the second paragraph. Representatives of the United States Food and Drug Administration had been blocked from entering China. despite growing evidence that the tainted pet food had killed at least 16 dogs and cats and sickened thousands of other animals in the United States. And it originated with Chinese exporters of wheat, gluten, and other animal feed ingredients. We import 80% of the wheat and rice protein that we use in the United States. Most of it's used in pet foods, but an awful lot of it is used in livestock feed, and some of it is used in human foods. We import 80% of it. Is that a good thing? When you're importing 80% of one of your essential food stuffs? I would submit to you that the fact that we are importing all this stuff and we have no significant control over what's coming into the country from outside, no inspection of it. This is why we need domestic industries. This is a strong argument in favor of laws and regulations that encourage domestic industries and discourage the import, particularly of uninspected, unregulated products. We've heard about the New York Times broke a story a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, about the incredible pesticide contamination, I mean toxic pesticide contamination of imported flowers. I don't think anybody has done the investigative work yet. I mean, there's so few Greg Palast's in the world. I don't think anybody has done the investigative work yet on the pesticides and herbicides and other chemicals that might be on our imported foods. But frankly, I see this as an economic story more than anything else. If people are talking, you know, they're concerned about their pets dying. But I think that this is an economic story, and it ties into another story that Martin Kretzinger wrote for the Associated Press. He writes, 3 weeks ago, Dawn Zimmer became a statistic. Laid off from her job assembling trucks at Freightliner's plant in Portland, Oregon, she and 800 of her colleagues joined a long line of U.S. manufacturing workers who have lost jobs in recent years. A total of 3.2 million, one in six U.S. factory jobs, have disappeared since the start of 2000. As Zimmer, Dawn Zimmer, who lost her job, she says, she's been with Freightliner since 94. She said, they're building a multi-million dollar plant in Mexico, and they're going to build the Freightliners down there. They came in and videotaped us at work so they could train the Mexican workers, end quote. So now we have a situation where 84% of Americans in the labor force are employed in service jobs, up from 81% in 2000. Service sector increasing, manufacturing down. And you say, well, there's no problem. We, you know, service jobs. You need people who are CPAs and who can read x-rays and things. Well, satellites, fiber optic cable, all that. Today it's quoting the Associated Press, today it's call centers in India and the Philippines. But tomorrow, many more U.S. jobs could move offshore. Princeton economist Alan Blinder, who was vice chairman of the Federal Reserve during the Clinton administration, says the number of jobs at risk of being shipped out of the country could reach 40 million over the next 10 to 20 years. That's one of every three service sector jobs at risk. Up to a third of the manufacturing jobs that we have lost are the direct result of our soaring trade deficit. See, it all comes back to insane trade policies. People drinking the Friedman, both Milton and Tom, Kool-Aid. Last year's trade deficit, $765.3 billion. The imbalance with China hit an all-time high for a single country at $232 billion. And one of the reasons that they're able to make this stuff so cheaply in China, because they're using coal, you know, old-fashioned coal-fired technology to generate their electricity. It's much cheaper, along with their labor, which is much cheaper. So now, in today's paper, we're finding that China is soon going to surpass the United States as the number one emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Why? So we can buy more cheap junk at Walmart and not have jobs. What's wrong with this picture? I mean, this is seriously broken. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Price for truth, and money doesn't breed red, white, and blue. Oh, no, 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 and it never won't. Oh, say.
Indeed, we need to recapture freedom here in the United States. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners. Listening during our breaks for opportunities to support your local radio station by letting the sponsors know that you're listening. And, of course, buying their products or recommending them to other people. The local sponsors, of course, for your local stations, and, of course, our national sponsors as well, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MAX, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, E-C-O-W-I-N-E, 1-888-ECO-WINE. 35 minutes past the hour. This is, I see this as one, the fabric of one entire whole. And I just want to just very, very quickly recap all this, and then we'll take your calls here on it. We're importing 80% of our wheat and rice protein. And now we're discovering that the stuff that we're importing from China has been contaminated, and we never even knew to look for it. Why? Because it's more profitable to contaminate it. They're contaminating it with melamine because it's an amine. Amines are the building blocks of proteins. So if you're measuring protein compound and there's a lot, if you're looking for proteins, if you're using a standard way of measuring proteins and there's a lot of amino acids in there, it's going to kick up the counter. So it looks like it's higher in protein or protein than it is. So it's more profitable. Apparently melamine is cheaper than wheat protein. At the same time, we have lost 3 million factory jobs since 2000. Back 40 years ago, four out of 10 jobs were manufacturing jobs. Now we're down to 1 out of 10. We're not growing things in the United States anymore. We're not making things in the United States anymore. China is, over the next decade, going to surpass the United States. Now, this is not a badge of honor. It's just simply a statement of how it's working. This from today, Shea Oster, today's Wall Street Journal. Chinese leaders say that since the major developed economies grew rich using their own cheap energy, mostly coal, China should have the same privilege. They say any caps would break economic growth, forcing China to slow its development. Over the next 10 years, the IEA forecasts China will add the equivalent of an entire European Union's worth of power plants. The entire European Union, over the next decade, added to what China already has. Why? Again, so we can have cheap stuff. And where are we getting the money to buy all this cheap stuff? Brian Blackstone, writing in today's Wall Street Journal, home equity served as a growing source of funds for American consumers from the early 1990s to 2005, when it financed close to 4% of total personal consumption expenditures. We're using our homes as ATMs. Used to be you'd buy a home with a mortgage with the goal of over 20 or 30 years paying off the mortgage so that when you retired, your home was paid off and you didn't have to make any more payments on it. And it was an equity. It was something you could leave to your children, to the next generation. Maybe they could live in it. Maybe they could, you know, add on to it, whatever. Between 1991 and 2000, consumers used cash withdrawn from the equity in their homes to finance only 6/10 of overall spending. That share rose to 1.75% in 2005. So from during the Clinton economy, it dropped down to 0.6%. Back up to 1.75%. And using the broader measure, home equity extraction accounted for 3.7% of consumption in 2005, more than double its share from just 5 years earlier. In other words, people are having to borrow against their homes in order to keep their head above water. Why? 26 years of insane conservative economics. That's what it boils down to. Very, very simply. And now on top of this, we have William Watts of MarketWatch writing this piece, the headline, Medicare Fund to Run Dry by 2019. Nowhere in here does he mention the fact that what is killing Medicare is the poison pill that they put in it of the federal government through Medicare must pay full price for prescription drugs to domestic drug manufacturers. So here we have a subsidy for the domestic pharmaceutical industry, but we're not going to protect any other industries. And this isn't even protecting an industry. This is really killing Medicare. That's the whole point of it. The trustees now project that Medicare's Insurance Hospital Trust Fund will run dry by 2019 without changes in the popular entitlement program. Who says so? Gee, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Now, he wants to reform Medicare and Social Security. How would he like to reform them? Well, let's privatize them, of course. Gee, I wonder what Henry Paulson used to do for a living. He was the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs, the private investing firm where, of course, if you're going to privatize Social Security and Medicare, you're going to put your money. It's nuts. It's nuts. He's calling, Charles Schumer says, this threshold, there's this threshold that they've hit, and it's created what's called a fund warning. Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt, another Bushy. We have a fund warning. It's required as part of the 2003 law that created the Medicare prescription drug program, that if Medicare gets in trouble, they have to issue a fund warning. In other words, they have to say, look out, Will Robinson, time to change the rules of this. That's because this was a poison pill. This whole prescription drug thing was put in there in the first place to destroy Medicare. And, by the way, at the same time, to make a few billion, tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars in profits for their cronies and buddies and campaign donors in the big pharma. Charles Schumer says, this threshold is nothing less than another way to choke off funds to seniors who need help. Amen and well said. Steve, driving in Tennessee. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, Steve, you're on the air.
This is Steve.
You're live and on the air, Steve.
Okay. I'm a Vietnam vet. I'm 58 years old. I'm probably going to be opening up a can of worms here, and I don't mean to. I just, like Lieutenant Callie, he was ordered to do what he did. I was in special ops or black ops, whatever you want to call it, Marine Corps. I was a captain. We were ordered to take our own people out because they knew too much. And they were going
in
against
Vietnam,
the government. Sir?
You're talking about in Vietnam.
Yes, sir, in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking
Are you suggesting ultimately here that that's what happened to Pat Tillman? Is that where you're going with this?
I'm not suggesting that, but that is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, of course, we had weapons of everybody's. If you got a poker game on a Friday night, a Sunday night, if you had won or got a hard time with it, Sunday night in the patties, you'd end up dead.
Yeah. Don't you think, though, Steve, that if they wanted to kill Pat Tillman, that they would have found a way to do it that was a whole lot less clumsy than what they did? Don't you think that, you know, giving him something that would cause it to look like he picked up a local variation of dysentery and died from it or something? You know, it's just there's so many ways to kill somebody that are just a lot less messy. Messy in terms of, you know, having to hide it all.
No, sir. I hope that some of my brothers from the Vietnam War, I hope some of them call in and they'll tell you what I'm saying is true.
Mm-hmm.
When we're ordered from the top to take out one of our own men, that would be like me killing my wife. It's extremely difficult, but yet you have to do it because that's what your direct orders are. We were ordered to do, you know, our direct orders. I mean, that's if you get a direct order, you do what you're told. And it's sad. And our boys over there now, they're in the same kind of war that we were in. It's a political war.
Yeah, the bottom line, war is hell here.
They don't belong there. And you know what's funny to me is I had a degree in child psychology. And when I came home in 1972, they were paying $8,000 to $11,000 a year. My dad was a truck driver. My dad was making $18,000 to $22,000 a year. Well, I had a wife and three children. And I couldn't work for $8,000 to $11,000 a year. There was no way I could do it. So I went ahead and drove a truck. Well, that's 35 years ago, and I'm still driving a truck.
Well, it's an honorable profession.
And now I'm going to change the subject on this here.
Yeah. Steve, I'm sorry. Your point is made and well made, and I've got to move along. I got a whole pile of other callers here, but thank you very much for calling in and sharing with us. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi. I'm calling about we're talking about these shipments from China.
Yeah.
In 1997, 60 Minutes did a report on glycerin that was sent to a children's pharmaceutical company in Haiti that was, in fact, contaminated with antifreeze. Its source was China.
Mm-hmm.
And when they went to investigate, they found pretty much that the Chinese had done that on purpose because antifreeze was cheaper than glycerin.
Right.
And 96 children died because of that.
Oh, man. Yeah, see, I mean, this is the wonders of the free market. I mean, isn't it great? Capitalism will solve all problems if we simply allow the corporations and the profit motive to work. After all, enlightened self-interest is the best thing, isn't it? No, we are social animals. Community is the best thing. Compassion and understanding, odd as they may sound, are actually the best thing. That's what this country was founded on. You know, of the six items listed in the preamble to the Constitution, five of them have to do with holding people up and giving them potential. Only one has to do with our defense. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And don't forget, you can join us in Dubrovnik, Croatia, for the conference Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. This is June 3rd through the 9th, 2007. I will be broadcasting this program live from Croatia. We'll be there with Rianne Eisler, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Moore LePay, Swami Beyondananda, and more. You can check out details at praxispeace.org. This is the Praxis Peace Conference. P-R-A-X-I-S, peace, P-E-A-C-E dot O-R-G. If you're interested in hanging out with us for a week in Dubrovnik, Croatia, an amazing place. Victoria Jones and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Good morning, Ellen. Good morning, Victoria. Hey, Victoria.
Good morning. Well,
or afternoon, or whatever it is. Yeah, it's afternoon, isn't it, for both of you?
It is afternoon.
And Victoria, you had a story to share. You both have stories to share with us, but let's start with you, Victoria.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, you've been talking about the Office of Special Counsel and the investigation of Karl Rove, I imagine, with a certain amount of glee. So I won't dwell on that. I imagine you've talked about that extensively.
We spent most of our first hour on it. Yeah.
I thought you would have done. I thought you'd be interested to know about my run-in with Dana Perino yesterday. When I asked, I sent you the email of the transcript about this earlier today. I asked what I thought was a fairly innocent question. I mildly inquired whether there was concern that between them, Kyle Sampson, Alberto Gonzalez, had said, "I don't recall," over 200 times, and whether that reflected some kind of a lack of memory at the upper echelons of the Justice Department.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was accused of making an outrageous comment.
Oh, my. Well, you know, Reagan was eating a lot of jelly beans, and there were some folks who had some wags suggested that jelly beans are made out of mostly gelatin, and gelatin comes from rendered down cows, and maybe he had mad cow disease. And maybe there's a whole bunch of Reagan's jelly beans still floating around the White House, and Karl Rove and Kyle Sampson have been eating them.
Maybe that's the snack.
There you go. I mean, you know, maybe we've got an epidemiological mystery solved here.
You know, they just need to bring in the CDC.
There you go. There you go. Dana did not take that question to be
she was
in all seriousness.
She was apoplectic. She was livid. Livid with me. Yes.
Now, isn't it a little bizarre that a White House spokesman would be angry with a reporter for asking a question?
Well, I don't think that she. I think she may have thought that I wasn't asking it in the true sense of journalistic. I don't know whatever, but I genuinely was. I mean, it seems to me that if you've got people at the upper echelon of the Justice Department who don't remember anything, that you might have a problem on your hands.
Right. And so journalism these days, in Dana Perino's mind, means suck up to the Bush administration, period, end of discussion. Is that
or ask predictable questions that she's prepared for.
Yeah. That's tragic. Ellen Ratner, you have a story to tell.
Well, first of all, Harry Reid is sticking to his guns, and I'm glad he's doing that. He just gave a press conference on Capitol Hill. But also this morning on Capitol Hill, Congressman Eric Cantor, his deputy Republican chief deputy whip, he held a press conference concerning the hate crimes bill, H.R. 1952. He had Bishop Harry Jackson and about a dozen preachers and about 100 black Christians, and they were saying that in terms of they want to keep homosexuals out of the hate crime legislation. They say sinners need to be judged by God, not treated specially by the law. They also said these changes threaten Christian free speech. This motivates cross-dressers and homosexuals. Changes to the hate crime agenda would make homosexual issues more palatable. And Satan needs to recoil because he missed this time.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, this is an elected official who is allowing this to go on with 100 African-American Christians, and one of them also said that blacks cannot be wake up and be black, and they said they haven't found a homosexual gene yet.
This is incredible, Ellen. I mean, there's no black gene either. I mean, being African-American, that to the extent that there is race, there really is no gene for race. There's thousands of genes. There's genes that define the color of one's hair, the color of one's eyes, but there's no one gene for race either. I mean, it's not to say that there may not be one for sexual orientation, but the bottom line is this is an argument that's not all that different from the one that the Mormon Church made for over 100 years, that African Americans were that dark skin was the mark of Cain, that it was a proof that they were the descendants of you know, the original murderer, and therefore they should be shunned.
It is rather unbelievable that we are paying our elected officials for such racism. And I mean racism in the broadest term, and that they had this on Capitol Hill today to try and derail the hate crimes legislation. Now, what's also interesting is that Steny Hoyer today talked about the hate crimes legislation, and he said that any time you go after a class of individuals, no matter who they are, and he was obviously talking about gay people or black people or whatever, he said that in our multicultural society is really a bad thing because it is very divisive and it allows society to essentially come apart. He said to go after people, to allow people to go after them because there are a certain class of people, and then to do a crime because of that, he said, cannot be tolerated in a free society.
Yeah, indeed. Well said. And who, again, was the elected representative who was allowing the screaming hatred, homophobic hatred?
Is the Republican chief deputy with Eric Cantor.
Eric Cantor. I hope we all remember that name well. He's somebody who should be held responsible, you know, held to account for... that's just vicious. That's just vicious. Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up tomorrow on Air America Radio on the Tom Hartman program, I'll be challenging conservative Joseph Farah about our newsrooms, and Pierre Epstein is here. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.